You're listening to Out There Atlanta, a podcast featuring interviews with artists in Atlanta and beyond, conducted in the spirit of a casual conversation. Out There Atlanta is sponsored by burnaway.org, an online destination for dialogue about the arts. Music for this podcast was provided by MSIF. For this week's podcast, I spoke with Jason Kofke. Jason is an Atlanta-based artist whose work has taken him all over the world. Most recently, he did a residency in the Arctic Circle. Here's Jason to tell you all about it.
Hi, I'm Jason Kofke, an artist, Atlanta-based artist, and I use Atlanta mainly as a studio base from which to travel overseas and get involved in as many residency programs as I can.
How long has Atlanta been your base?
See, I kind of kept bouncing back and forth between here and Savannah while I was in school. The Savannah College of Art and Design opened a campus here, so I came here my last year of undergrad and then went back to Savannah and then went to New York and then came back to Atlanta. So 2007-ish is when I started getting involved, and there have been times where years gone by where I wasn't here, but my studio has been based here since about 2006, 2007.
And you got both your BFA and MFA from SCAD?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yep. I started school a little late. I was 22 when I started, so I didn't want to waste time. I just rolled right into grad school.
So last year you had a big show, The Ends, at Beep Beep Gallery with Chris Chambers, and then you followed that up with another show at Kibbe Gallery called Little Victories, also with Chris Chambers and with Matt Whitehead. And since then, you have been traveling a lot, and I would be really interested to know, first of all, about that Arctic residency that you did. I know you had a big Kickstarter for that, so I'd love to hear about, you know, what the fundraising was like for that, if that was your first Kickstarter, and then, of course, you know, what actually happened in the residency and what came out of that, and then some more about your more recent travels as well.
Okay. The Arctic Circle, well, all these residencies, I should bracket, started with my first residency overseas, which was a year in China through the China Academy of Art. And I just got used to, first I moved there, settled in for a few months, and thank God, on a whim, my mom came to visit. It was completely unplanned. She found a cheap plane ticket. She was sad and alone for the holidays. So what it did is it forced me to stop living in the little room they provided for me and going to the same restaurant. I had to actually learn enough Chinese to get around China on my own, because I wasn't going to have the Chinese students that were helping me while I was there, and I had to find all these things to do in China. So once I managed to survive Upper Manchuria and the Gobi Deserts and all, just so many things that I can't believe I even made it back to the place I was staying in China, let alone the States, I got a real bug for travel and the experience. So toward the end of that year, I panicked and realized that, oh no, I'm going back to the United States, and I was fully Chinese. I had a Chinese bank account and a cell phone and a job and a girlfriend, and the thought of coming home to starting all over again, I wasn't excited about. So I started just applying to residencies, and since then, it seems about 1 in 10 or 1 in 12 I will be invited to participate in. So so that's how all that started, the travels. Mm-hmm. So you want to get into the Arctic Circle?
Yeah, let's hear about the Arctic Circle.
Doing all these applications to residencies, I started to notice there were some that stood out to me in different parts of the world, and many of them were far more competitive than others. The Arctic Circle is one of those. The name of it is arcticcircle.org, and it's a residency where there's 20 to 25 architects, designers, researchers, artists, scientists, kind of inventors and free thinkers assembled from around the world. We get a little over two weeks on a 150-foot sailing vessel sailing around the Arctic Circle, around a region called Svalbard, which is administered by Norway, but is its own independent country or territory. And just exchange ideas, do our projects. Mainly we just talked, hung out, and tried a lot of things that failed and tried to keep warm. But the residual ideas and contacts, I think, is where the worth of that residency was. So back to how I got it. The ones that were standing out to me, I realized, were ones that I was going to have to keep applying to. for years on end, and eventually my year would come up. And the Arctic Circle wasn't funded. It was one that you'd have to raise your own funds, and it was somewhere between $6,000 to $10,000 probably to pull the whole thing off, which is a very intimidating number to me. So I thought I would just keep applying for years until I developed my career and had, I guess, more clout, more financial stability. But that didn't work that way. Within my second or third application, my third year applying, I was accepted, and I didn't want to pass it up. So I looked at Kickstarter. That seemed like an obvious one, and it was the best. I had some help making a video with some designers that are here in town, and wrote the script. It all kind of just fell together, fortunately. And I was able to fund it, and here I am 6 or 7 months late on many of my Kickstarter, some of the bigger ones, because I'm still working on drawings and stuff. I think that's pretty normal for Kickstarter, though.
Is it like a wedding? You have a year to fulfill the gift?
Yeah, I told them when I try to get it to them. I'm a few months past that, but yeah. I'd rather send, for people who contributed, I'd rather send quality things if it took a little time than just do a quick drawing. I'm still working on.
What were some of the big ticket items on your Kickstarter?
Well, the biggie was some friends from who were in a different grad school that they did the big prize, which was the sketchbook, all the ideas, everything, and all the other prizes. So they got sketches, Polaroid, posters, postcards, so most of those things. But that sketchbook has turned in, well, the problem is I didn't really keep a sketchbook there. The last thing I wanted to do was draw outside, and there was just so much going on, I didn't want to organize it. So.
What was the average temperature while you were in the Arctic?
It really wasn't that bad. Chicago, which blew my mind. There was one day that I was down, we were hiking, and I stripped everything off, was carrying everything like a snowman, and was just down to a long-sleeve shirt. I was actually dying of heat. But then there were other times where it was, negative, no, that's not true. I'm doing the math.
From Celsius to Fahrenheit?
Like 10, 8 in Fahrenheit. Still not so bad, but when it's windy on a boat, it felt a lot worse.
Yeah.
So it was still cold. I would want to hang out. You know,
but
nobody
hangs
out
unbearable.
In Chicago. Right, it wasn't unbearable. It was about 3 or 4 hours, and then my feet were gone. And I was like, all right, I've got to get back on the boat for at least an hour. So what I've done instead is put together all of the photos, which became my sketchbook. And I'm working on a interesting way of printing them to assemble into a book to send off.
So what sort of, just to clarify, what sort of practice did you intend to have for the duration of the Arctic Circle expedition, and or how did you end up retooling that expectation?
Now that I went back and reread it, it was pretty exact. For this application, again, because I thought I was going to just keep applying for years on end, I thought I'll just make this one really simple. I stripped down the previous year's application, which was going to be filming and developing and screening 8mm films there, and my plan was to project them onto icebergs, which I realize, having done it now, that would have been almost entirely impossible, and if it was possible, it would have been very dangerous to get that close. But this year's was pretty much that. I'm going to hang out, take pictures, and do some drawings, and that's what worked. But it seems like the previous year it was a lot of sound artists, whereas this year it was a lot of writers and people working with older technologies and more basic things. I was using older photography equipment. So it was my year because it was people who were just doing drawings and paintings and sketches and just taking photos and doing photographic experiments.
Nice. So do you think that the residency responded better to something that, from their experience, they found to be more realistic?
Yes. And I think that me having more experience throughout the years and doing residencies prior to getting accepted, slowly I realized that the more simple my application, the more I can actually do it, and the better it works for everybody.
Yeah. What sort of connections were made then between you and the other researchers on the expedition? And did you find, say, sort of surprising relationships with people that were, say, writers or scientists or people that were outside of your field?
Absolutely. However, it was the ones that really struck me were the ones that were kind of dabbling in the same things that I was. I feel like in Atlanta and I guess in this region, I've become something of my own little personal guru of old media, and that stems from having a lot of experience in printmaking, to where I changed my perception to view as the Xerox as a printmaking device, and 8mm film, video, VHF transmissions, all these things is just another form of media that is just, I bracket it all under this printmaking, outdated media. And I thought I really knew my stuff, but I met some people there that just blew my mind, and I've already approached some of them and said, hey, I found a few other residencies. I found one in Alaska that's coming up, I think in 2015, and I've already said, let's do this again. Let's try to go. And cause my only complaint about the Arctic Circle was that there were so many people with so much input. There were a few that I really wanted to just hang out with for days on end and dig their mind. So I'm specifically artist Robert. He built or brought a camera obscura or a camera lucida, and he built one in the Arctic, a camera obscura that he was doing his drawings with, so he'd have this white tent that folded up into a book bag, and everything was just light based, very old, simple mechanics. We were in a place called Barrettsburg, which is probably the highlight for me of the trip, which is an abandoned coal mining outpost from the Soviet era. And when the Soviet Union started to fall apart, the 2,000 inhabitants, they said, you've got a day to pack and you're leaving the next day. Everybody leave. So it's this coal mining city that's small. It's probably about a half mile to a mile in area. Buildings, dorms, hospital, little grocery store, all completely abandoned just as it was. It's like a little theater, old piano. But we found a movie theater, and we found just rolls and rolls of 35mm films laying around. And, of course, Robert, he was the MacGyver of the group, he pulled out a lamp-lit projector that he just happened to bring, and we could screen the films in this abandoned movie theater from the Soviet era, and we could see these images that were abandoned in this barren, frozen wasteland. That was amazing.
Wow, what kind of films were they?
Well, I don't think any of us spoke Russian. No. We didn't have sound, of course, but it looked like the ones that we looked at had a fighter jet flying around. It looked like some kind of World War One, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Or fighter jet one, and then we looked at another one that had a pilot that looked like World War One era. And then, I don't know, people in dialogue from the 80s in Soviet era. Who knows what they were saying? But
yeah.
But it was a room about the size of a walk-in closet, and it was, you had to wade through maybe 6 inches of just unrolled film. All these just films just abandoned laying around.
Wow. What was the preservation quality of these?
That's it. That was the stipulation, was they were well-preserved. Everything was there. No power, of course. And those days were particularly cold. So it's frustrating as an artist. I wanted to play so bad, but my gloves, I had space gloves on, and it's hard to like see and operate and get a good view of things. And but the reason it's preserved is because of the rule that you can't take anything. You can touch things and move gently, but don't take a thing. And it was just excruciating, the things that I saw, and I thought, I want to bring that home and, you know, run it through my projector so bad. Or some old books that the papers I could use to make drawings out of, but I wanted to respect the place too, because I figured that people will come from here on out to see that. There's a band called Efterklang. It's a Scandinavian band. They play kind of shoegazy music, but their whole album was recorded there, I think, half a year before we got there. So,
oh, wow.
Us Americans, there are a few American artists from New York, and we were all really excited. We found this little gold mine that nobody knew about, this Soviet-era thing where these pictures are going to be amazing, and our sound recordings are going to be great. And it turns out that
pop culture got there first.
Yeah, the hipster band found it first, and they did a really good job, though.
Yeah, you like their album?
Yeah.
What sort of sound effects were they able to get from the space?
Is
it audibly different sounding as a record, or is it just sort of like the trace of the place?
I think it's a little of both, where, of course, because there's so much snow, there's a walkway that's built all out of wood that is still held up pretty well, so for example, one of their drum beats was just one of the singers running, so it's just his footsteps echoing on this very long wooden walkway from building to building. It's like boom, 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 boom. And another one was, of course, the grand piano. There's an abandoned grand piano that's terribly out of tune, of course, after over 15 or 20 years of being abandoned in the Arctic. And it is the ghostliest sound, because you can play it and everything is a little out of tune. Fortunately, one of the writers that was there was a classically trained piano player, and he broke into the Moonlight Sonata, and it was just phenomenally eerie, because the grand piano was on stage in the movie theater / theater, and because it was a theater, there was no lighting, there's no ambient lighting, so it was pitch black, and we all just had little flashlights, so it's just this pitch black, abandoned, very cold Arctic outpost with Moonlight Sonata in this abandoned Soviet grand piano.
That sounds incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Did anyone have sound recording equipment?
Lots.
So it exists somewhere?
Yes. Ruth is an Irish citizen artist living in Berlin, so she's making work with it now. Leah Bieferman, she's a New York artist, and I think she's collaborated with a few of the visual artists. And she's got sound effects of the icebergs melting. And we all were lucky to see a glacier calve. And I think she was the one who captured it. But also the reason a lot of us were there was because the scientific research going on. And she recorded the ESCIT, ESCET, which is a atmospheric measuring radar station. It looks like something out of James Bond movies. It's this 300-foot... diameter satellite dish that's measuring ions in the atmosphere. So she's got recordings of all these equipment. I guess in the end, the ideas that a lot of us were batting around, a lot of things I was trying to conceive, was this concept of nature and culture, where we were suddenly stripped of culture and the comforts of man when you're out there, let alone just your, you know, the things that you're carrying on your back. And you get this real sense of, well, it isn't that nature's cruel or harsh, it's this, it just doesn't care. It is what it is. And in that environment, you don't become adversity to it. You just kind of blend in and you are too. I think there are some real, you know, dangers where there were times we had to stay indoors because if a wave came over the ship, then there's no hope. There's no getting you out in time. It's just, that's it. So
wow.
They try to keep that risk down. And we always had 3 or 4 guns in a perimeter wherever we went in case of polar bears. And we had to, like, know exactly what to do. You couldn't say the word polar bear unless it actually was. We had to call them our white fuzzy friends, which got kind of annoying.
Huh.
Felt great when we all got back to the airport. We're like, polar bear, polar bear, polar bear. That's so much easier to say than white fuzzy friend.
But they wanted it to be a real emergency word. Like, you hear it and you've been sort of hardwired to recognize immediately danger and go into action.
And the stories I heard, I could see why. There's one time where we went on a hike and we found the tracks going back that weren't there on the way out, and that really spooked everyone. So there was just one moment where the gentleman with the lead gun said, oh, I'm going to watch the back, you go over that crest. And as I went over the crest, apparently there was another gun on the other side, but suddenly it was just me and another artist, Lucas, from Austria, and we realized, like, if there's a bear over on this hill, we have no protection. And it's like, we just had this 45 seconds of, oh, this, if you didn't have a gun and armed and you were just up here alone, this would be very real. This is pretty terrifying.
Huh. Sounds like you left with a lot of newfound respect and appreciation for the environment.
I think so, yeah.
Not necessarily in a green way, but just like,
yeah,
sort of the existential, like, insignificance versus the magnitude and physicality of the environment.
Yeah, I think that's what the physicality is, just the reality that that there's a kind of balance. And when you're, I don't know, you get the sense that we all live in this bubble, which I guess we do. But it's that Baudrillard problem. If it's the bubble, then, and that's what we're used to living to, and then is this not our reality? Is this not our nature? So, I don't know, these are things I haven't quite figured out, but it's got me thinking about that.
Yeah.
And that really wasn't anything I thought about before that residency. I was just kind of caught up in the art world and media and television and how, you know, the things that most artists are caught up in, I think.
So has this sent your work in a different direction? Or it sounds like your thinking at least has shifted dramatically for now.
For the work, honestly, I don't think so. I can't see it. I can't point to anything to say, oh, this is a result of that. But my philosophy and my outlook has changed. And the director of the program, Aaron O'Connor, an artist himself, and kind of a really cool individual. I'm glad I got to meet him. But he's done it for years now, and he said that typically what he's noticed, the trend with other previous artists who've done it, is that 3 or 4 years later, he hears back from them and says, you know, this major show that I'm having, or this major breakthrough, or this piece that I made, I couldn't have conceived it if I hadn't gone on that. But he said usually people there don't have breakthroughs. They just experience. So I took that to heart, and I'm not trying to force anything.
Yeah. Huh, that's an interesting sort of timeline, like a 4-year incubation period mm-hmm. for the ideas to reemerge or really come into fruition. Now that you've burst your bubble and thinking about the art world, it sounds like you're continuing to think outside the bubble and look to even bigger and better residencies after this.
True. After that time in China, and it's always this idea that I had there is always kind of reaffirmed every time I do a residency, is that everybody maybe just gets caught up in their routine and their world, and breaking out of that is like being, not to sound so cheesy, but being born again. And I mean that in a very practical way, because in China, I can't understand the conversations around me, and I can't read the signs. And the words that I know are the words that I need in order to attain food or water or get direction. So it's basically, and those things I had to learn quickly. And I noticed the same trends going on in my 3-year-old nephew. So I'm like, it is like being completely a child again. And he has his own creativity and his own way of understanding things. And you develop that when you're in an ulterior environment. So it's this burst of viewing things differently, maybe even properly, and viewing things as a child, just hugely inspiring. And there's no clutter because I can't see every advertisement. It all just becomes this environment, and I become lost in my own world. And I don't think it's just me. I think that's a pretty common experience. So I'm hungry for it. I keep applying. I just got back from the Czech Republic, and that was ideal, where I was in a town about the size of Savannah, Georgia, but instead of being Civil War era history, it was medieval history and castles that you walk through. But not a whole lot catered to me in my language. There were tourist sections, of course, but I tried to avoid those. I learned enough to get by in restaurants and stuff, but there's no clutter, there's no commercials, there's nothing that gets through. It's just whatever words I allowed myself to know in mm-hmm. that culture.
Were you doing a residency there? Or mm-hmm. Were you
a small one called Milkwood Residency? It was a gentleman in Chicago now who owned a house there, and I think it's somewhat of a relic of the Cold War too, or the Iron Curtain era, where he wanted to keep an exchange between the East and West, and now he just maintains it as a place for what a proper artist residency is, just a place for you to live. An inspiring place and just get work done. So it also was very cold for some reason. It was this winter is evil, and I didn't expect to get really into going outside and doing etchings and drawing. I had these preconceived notions of doing these elaborate drawings, and I actually just scaled down a lot and just enjoyed kind of the traditional going outside and drawing what I see.
Yeah. Was there another small community of artists at this residency as well, or was it just you?
It was just me.
Wow.
That was pretty nice. It's different.
It seems like that has the potential to be just as eerie as being in the Arctic, but in a very different way.
Yes. There are eerie in a comfortable way. Scary, but a scariness I'm part of, so it's okay. If I don't get any residencies for a little while, it's fine with me. I have a show again. This one will be solo show at Beep Beep in September. And then a show early the next year in 2015 at Kylan Gallery that's kind of intimidating because it's a really big space.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a new space, and that'll be a solo show also. So I did the math this morning. I've got 14 weeks before that first show. I'm going to be working on both of them simultaneously. One is titled Everything All Together All at Once, and the other one is Heraclitus.
Heraclitus at Kylan?
Mm-hmm. So far.
So, last year you really made a big splash with the show at Beep Beep. For one, you brought your car into mm-hmm. Beep Beep Gallery, which, as anyone who saw the show will know, that car could not have possibly fit through the door. It sort of seemed to have appeared magically, although we both know that yeah. it was not magic at all, but rather grunt labor and some clever engineering. Can you give the listeners any sort of hint as to what you're thinking of for the show, or any idea of what direction you're going in?
Sure.
And we'll all understand that this is subject to change in the next couple months.
Hopefully not. Hopefully not. The works I want to be pretty simple, and I've got this really elaborate installation piece that may or may not work that will also be a large, cumbersome thing in the middle of the gallery. It works because it's such a small space. So, and it also will require some clever engineering, so it won't be a car, but it will be something. And the works, coming out of the ideas that I was digging into at the ends, I was trying to look more at the history and how things are interconnected, which started to dig into politics. So now all of a sudden I'm thinking all these political ideas, and I really like to stay away from that as an artist because I feel like it's so present and then remains in the present once that political era is done. And so we'll see how this goes. I'm trying to look at specific things, good and bad events, but also trying to compare them to the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, it'll be simple, a simplified show, just a few ideas in this installation. And then I'm doing the same thing again a few months later. I've got another show back-to-back, kind of, and I think this is maybe the way that I'd like to work.
Sort of rapid-fire residencies yeah. and exhibitions?
Yep.
When was your last solo exhibition in Atlanta? I know you had a solo exhibition at a university in Florida last year as well, or 2 years ago?
Two years ago. I think solo exhibition in Atlanta, the last one was in 2008.
Oh, wow.
I think it's been a while. I had one that I count as a solo exhibition in Japan in 2010 because it was me and three other artists, but we each had a studio, but that studio was twice the size of Beep Beep Gallery, so that was probably the last really big kind of mm-hmm. combination of things that was all me. But I feel like I'm ready for it. I've got plenty of ideas, and
yeah.
it's just a matter of pulling it all together.
Has it been nice to... I mean, the group exhibitions that you've been in, especially recently in Atlanta, have been such collaborative efforts.
Mm-hmm.
They've been with artists that you plan the exhibition with, artists that you've worked with for a long time and know very well personally. How has it been working in that sort of... or exhibiting in that sort of situation versus thinking about solo projects again?
No offense to those artists that I work with, to Chris and Matt, but it was a nightmare. I'm sure they would say the same, but it was a good nightmare because...
You guys are still good friends, though.
Oh, yeah. I hope this stays true. I'll never let any disagreement in what paint, you know, what work should hang where or when, which wire color we should use ever come between our friendship. But we both have very distinct aesthetics that's very similar, but it's not exact. So... we butt heads and hope, and I think when the exhibitions are done, we butt heads in all the best ways and in good ways. And while I'm working with people, I hate it, and I'm sure they do too because we all have input. But stepping back from it, I love it. So I'm guessing the solo stuff will be freeing, but I fear it may not be as rich as an experience as I found with doing collaborative works with people that I'm excited to collaborate with and respect their work also.
I'm interested to know more about what you said earlier about trying to stay away from political art because it's so stuck in a time, because I think about some of the works of yours and the shows that I've seen in the past couple years, and For example, the ends at Beat Beat was all about the Challenger explosion. A lot of the works related to that event is sort of a marked thing, and yet you're treating it from the perspective of many years later, decades later, and it was a very political event. And I'm wondering how that fits into your idea of trying to stay away from sort of a current political context, mm-hmm. and getting your work frozen in that and not having a sort of timelessness. And if you're going to be moving away from doing works like the Challenger series, or if you feel like that is different than this idea of a sort of stuck in time political art.
No, you're right. I think the conundrum I'm having is that I can only talk about the Challenger for so much. I can only look at these historical events for so long. And before I start looking at very contemporary events and find, like, history, there's good and bad that came of this. I disagreed with this. We should have rethought this. I'm finding myself thinking that in current events, and it worries me because I don't have historical perspective. So to make a comment on it now, through a historical perspective years down the road, I may be David making paintings of Napoleon, or, you know, I may be saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, and I don't want to do that. Not because I'm afraid of looking stupid, or I just don't think that's not the role I want to play as an artist. I want to try to look at the bigger picture always, and not a socio-historical perspective, but a philosophical human perspective. That, mm-hmm. I think that's what we appreciate in the arts.
Yeah.
So I probably will dabble in contemporary events, hopefully with a sense of humor, which may be hard to swallow for some people. So we'll see.
In so many of your works, you use a lot of old technologies. We're here in your apartment right now. I'm looking at a wide range of old monitors and projectors and typewriters and just a very well-organized variety of old mediums. And I know that old paper is a medium that you really prefer to print on and enjoy, mm-hmm. for its qualities. Does this tie into your interest in sort of having some sort of distance, a historicizing distance or a philosophical distance from what is currently happening, and sort of detaching your work from any specific context?
Yes, and I think not only in the sense that it's historical media, but just hopefully by using these particularly sought-out objects as the transmitters of content, that those transmitters themselves are highlighted and become more apparent to the viewer. So hopefully we can look at the media that's providing our content now in a prehistorical vein, where we're seeing it differently. We're seeing it for what it is. It is affecting the way we view things, not just the content, but the media itself. And I know that's Marshall McLuhan, but he's will always be a fan. Maybe a little old-fashioned.
Yep. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you'd like to know more about Jason's work, head to his website, jasonkofke.com. That's www.jasonkofke.com. As always, check out burnaway.org for events, reviews, and articles about art. And check out our website, outthereartlanta.com, for photos and updates. Thanks for listening.